Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Media coverage always changes what it's covering. The questions asked, the frame drawn around an event or an issue, not only transmit a view of that subject, but also influence how the news unfolds, what people in the news decide to do next, how consumers of news interpret it. Sometimes the effect is subtle, but a huge concentration of reporters can generate a huge effect. At some points in Baltimore in the last 10 days, journalists have outnumbered activists and protesters. As curfew approached last night, and Democrat Elijah Cummings was using a bullhorn to urge residents to go home, a Fox News reporter trailed him with questions until the 7th District Congressman turned to him and his camera crew and said, "People are leaving. You're taking pictures of each other." For some insight into how all the attention from traditional media and social media is affecting understanding of Freddie Gray's death and its aftermath, we're turning to an observer of media and a practitioner. With me in the studio is Lester Spence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins. His most recent book is Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. Welcome to the show.
And thank you for having me.
And also with us is David Rosenthal, the Baltimore Sun's Senior Editor for Investigations. He edited the series last fall about police brutality in Baltimore, written by Mark Puente, called Undue Force. David Rosenthal, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sheila. It's nice to be here.
When events are moving so quickly as they did on Monday night, and with journalists now expected to report and file stories nearly in real time, how does the momentum of covering a story in that way shape the story, David?
Well, you have to be very cautious. As you mentioned, it's a round-the-clock publication cycle now for the newspaper and all other media. So, and some of those on Twitter and Facebook posts are being done without editors. So the reporters have to be very cautious about what they're saying and make sure that they're using the same standards that we would apply to the newspaper, the print newspaper itself. So we wouldn't take, for example, some rumor that somebody told us and just throw it up online without trying to verify it. A good example is yesterday there were online reports that Freddie Gray had a pre-existing medical condition and he'd been injured in a car accident. We didn't use that, although it was widespread online. Instead, we waited the next day until we could go to the courthouse in Howard County and check it. We had something up by about noon. Mark Puente and Doug Donovan did that story, and it probably had four times the traffic of any other story we printed yesterday or published online.
But Lester Spence, consumers of news, especially people who are deeply following the story, getting pretty sophisticated, are they more accepting of and more interested in watching the story unfold, warts and all, inaccuracies, retractions? Is that more okay now? David's presenting a fairly traditional view of source it, nail it down before you say anything. Is that really how news works now?
Well, that's how news works, fortunately, for the Baltimore Sun. But as far as the effect it has on the viewer, this is what the research says. The research suggests, and it's pretty clear, that the news has two different effects on consumers, right? One effect it has is it kind of shapes what they think of as important. So if the news is covering Baltimore, 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 people are probably more likely to say that urban issues are important than if not, right? Then the second thing that the research is pretty clear about is that how people who are participating in these instances are depicted, both their race and to a certain extent their gender, shapes people's policy preferences about that issue. So for example, when the turn goes from nonviolent protests to covering rioters, who in this case, because we're in Baltimore, tend to be predominantly Black and predominantly younger, then people see that, and the first thing they're thinking policy-wise is the thing they're more likely to think of policy-wise is, wow, the police need to be more heavy-handed in how they're dealing with this. And then they tend to support more law and order types of policies, right? So those are the two effects we know. What we're not sure of, and this is this is because of the 24-hour news cycle. One of the things that happens is that there's this affective or there's this emotional sense that people can't turn it off, right? So it's not like they're being sophisticated determining what to watch and what not to watch. It's that once the stream is on, it becomes something that they just can't turn away from, like a car accident. And then what we don't know is what type of emotional effect that has. I would thinking about it off the top of my head, I'm willing to bet that that kind of crystallizes pre-existing ideas about race and class, again, given how it's covered.
But David, what does that mean for print journalism, which is still how most facts get put on the table? I've done both. I was a print journalist for a long time before I went into broadcasting. And that, you didn't use the word addiction, but it almost sounds like an addiction to me that you're describing when a story heats up and it's coming at you from all different kinds of media and all different ways. In a way, newspapers stand apart from that.
Maybe because there's a little more thoughtfulness in the newspaper, and that you don't have to print it in 5 minutes. You know, you have a day to get it ready. But again, our world is changing so much that we have, on some days, more people reading us online than reading us in print. So we have to be, we're very attentive to what we're doing online. We have to be sort of cautious and be responsible that we, again, don't just react to what everybody else is publishing. I mean, the story I mentioned today that we printed was totally debunked what was online and these on a lot of conservative websites, and showed that that wasn't true at all. Their reports had nothing to do with the facts. And again, it was a very popular story, partly because I think we had that sort of people come to us to find out what's the truth. There's a lot of noise out there online. And so our goal, and we take this responsibility seriously, is to try and cut through the noise and tell people what's really true and what's not true.
Lester?
Now, and one thing I didn't talk about, there's a political economy to consider, right? So the Baltimore Sun, like other major newspapers, have had their budgets cut significantly. So one of the dynamics that he's not talking about, for understandable reasons, that's important to understand, is that the type of investigative work that he's doing, the type of investigative work that produced probably the most important article in understanding what's going on, is something that's happening less and less in major newspapers, in part because of the 24-hour news cycle, and in part because there's a decision, there's a tactical decision to engage in budget cuts. In order to move more towards opinion pieces. And what this does is it further, it makes it even harder for consumers to kind of understand an issue like what's going on through a really critical lens, as opposed to just what's going on through social media or Twitter.
I completely agree, and I just want to say, and I'm not going to ask you to comment on yourself, David, but you're right about the seminal effect that David and Mark's reporting has had, but the Sun has also been impressive in so much breaking news over the last 3 weeks and kind of being everywhere on this story. But I want to move.
Can I just make one point on that? It's a good point that there's pressure within the industry to consolidate, and that puts pressure on long form journalism and making sure that you have people to do investigations. But last year, the Sun took a really, I thought, bold step in hiring Mark and several other reporters and recreating an investigative team that we hadn't had in a while, and dedicating a lot of resources to that. And, you know, that's not an easy thing to do. It costs a lot of money, but it shows that it pays off. Yeah. And I thank you for, you know, that you like that story by Mark, because I think it did show a problem that had gone sort of under the radar for a long time in the city, and now we're sort of seeing what the result of that can be. You know, when something is, you know, hidden away for a long time, after a while it explodes.
That's David Rosenthal, Senior Investigations Editor at the Baltimore Sun, here on Maryland Morning at WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Lester Spence, Johns Hopkins Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies. And we're talking about how the media is covering events in Baltimore these days. I need to raise some controversies about language. Mayor Rawlings Blake offended many people by calling those who took part in the looting thugs. And this morning on CBS, the mayor pulled back from that word.
I regret it, and I've apologized several times. You know, it was very clear to me in the heat of what was going on, in the heat of this crisis, I let my anger overcome me.
But President Obama also referred to Monday's looters as thugs, and his spokesman, Josh Earnest, yesterday defended his use of that word.
Those were thuggish acts, and I think the president felt it was important to draw a clear distinction between those actions and the efforts of the vast majority of people in that community to draw attention to the legitimate concerns that they have about the treatment of Freddie Gray.
Lester, what struck you about the mayor putting the word thugs into the public discussion this week?
The mayor and I come from, well, we don't have the same backgrounds. I grew up working class, and she didn't necessarily grow up working class. But we're both professional now, both black professionals, right? And although we have two different jobs, as angry as I was about the incident, the thing I was angry about is that the police broke a kid's back. To the extent that I think about thuggish behavior, I think that you've got basically an illegitimate police force that over several years has acted thuggishly. But it's interesting that in anger, the first move she makes, the first rhetorical move she makes is towards her own constituents rather than the police force that she actually has some control over. So just as a kind of a, what it suggests is, and I know it sounds weird just talking about rhetoric, but what it suggests what that rhetoric suggests is that her philosophy of governance is not one that best fits the population she represents. And I'm glad she apologized. I wish the president would, but that apology, you can't pull that stuff back.
I have the impression that there are connotations and freight on that word that I wasn't aware of. I mean, David, do you look at that word and say, I could have stepped into that?
Yeah. Well, as a journalist, you have to be super careful about every word you put in a headline, every word you put in a story, how you phrase a demonstration. Is it a demonstration? Is it a protest? Is it a riot? You know, those are very charged words.
And that was the other language question I wanted to ask you. I remember in 2008 when WIPR did a lot of coverage of the 40th anniversary mm-hmm. of what took place mm-hmm. in Baltimore in 1968. And several people took us to school about calling it riots because they said that carries a connotation. It assumes something about the motives of those who are in the streets. It assumes something about the legality of what they did. And we found that when we scrubbed our copy, very often we could say civil unrest and with no loss of understanding by listeners. This week, I'm hearing what happened Monday called riots. Do you think that's appropriate?
Not having been on the scene. And actually, I was out of town when it happened. It was hard for me over the weekend to determine what was going on. The clips you see on TV are certainly people looting, breaking into stores and busting glass and that sort of thing. There didn't seem to be sort of the widespread violence against police, fistfights and gunfights and that sort of thing that I would characterize as a widespread riot. So it didn't really. Again, I'm looking at it from a distance. It didn't really seem like that to me. And when you look at Baltimore, certainly today or any day this week, you walk down around the streets and a lot of it is very calm. Doesn't mean that things are not tense and that there's not a lot of anger in the community. But I think the vision you get from outside Baltimore is that the whole city is on fire, and that's obviously not true. I've got a lot of emails and Facebook messages from folks saying, I hope you're safe.
Yeah,
please
are you okay?
Be safe. Yeah.
Oh my God, are you okay?
And I try to tell them, gee, I'm walking around the harbor and down to get lunch and everything's fine.
So it's surprising to me that you didn't know the connotations of that term.
Back on thug.
So the one other critique I'd levy, now this is actually a critique against the Baltimore Sun specifically. I used to do NPR and I would tape at the Baltimore Sun. Every time I would tape, and every time I walked in that room, in the newsroom, this huge newsroom filled with people, I would automatically increase the black representation by 33%. And then when I walk out the room, I decrease it by like 20, by the same degree. There'd be two black people in the room when I'd walk, the brother who watched sports and one other person, and then it'd be me. Right. And that's something where black people, now black people don't all agree. Like I was talking with my mom in Detroit yesterday, and she was there in 67 when Detroit had a protest, and she caused that a riot. So it's not like black people all agree, but increasing the number of black people and even people from Baltimore on that news staff in Baltimore, in that news staff, in the Sun's news staff, would increase the degree to which there at least be conversations about the appropriate language to use when stuff like this happens.
That is one of the many arguments for more diversity. You're absolutely right. I want to get into social media a bit. We just have a few minutes. But Lester, what do the hashtags Baltimore Uprising versus Baltimore Riots tell us about how language has shaped this debate?
Oh, wow. That's really interesting. I'm willing to bet that. So one of the things that happens, this goes back to the crystallization comment I mentioned before. At this point in time, you probably got two very, very stark consumers. One consumer group who tends to believe that policing is a primary problem urban cities face or urban areas face, and then one that believes that the rioters themselves are the problem urban areas face. And what those two hashtags kind of do is consolidate those two groups, I think.
Let me, in just the minute or so we have left, David, there's so much media of the events in Baltimore circulating, and so much of it is collected by non-journalists. I mean, we have such a different media picture than we had a couple years ago. Finds its way into public forums and discussions. How can people be aware of how the packaging affects what is published? How can people be more aware of what the source is, where it came from, what kind of credibility they should give it?
Yeah, again, I think you have to be very cautious about anything that's online because it can spread so fast like wildfire. And again, and for a simple example, I'll come back to that story we had about Freddie Gray and his, you know, so-called pre-existing injury. And this story, we probably had 10 emails about it within the space of an hour on the other night, which showed just how fast it was spreading on these right-wing sites. Again, we didn't do anything with it until we could confirm it in the courthouse. And when we went, the court paper showed something totally opposite. And so we had to debunk the story completely and say that it was totally false. And I think it's hard for the consumer because they don't really know all these websites out there. But that's, again, I hope our brand is more trusted and people will understand that we take more time with it and confirm things before we put them online. So maybe you trust us a little bit more before you jump at conclusions with another report.
Lester, short?
I agree. I really agree, and I really appreciate that effort, given in as much as there are a number of people who are putting forth stories on purpose to tell lies about what's going on here.
That's a pregnant thought on which to end, but we do have to end. I really appreciate your both talking to us. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
David Rosenthal is the Baltimore Sun's senior editor for investigations. He and reporter Mark Puente produced most of the series Undue Force last fall about police brutality in Baltimore and the amount the city has paid in judgments. Lester Spence is associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins. His most recent book is Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip Hop and Black Politics. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning, how one school, a remarkable teacher and her students, are handling the events of the last few weeks. Stay with us on 88.1.